Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I have the pleasure today of speaking with Kenneth Valpe, who is a research fellow at the Oxford Center of Hindu Studies and also at the Oxford Center of Animal Ethics. Hello, Kenneth. How are you?
Hello, Raj. I'm quite well.
Now, for those listening to our podcast in the timeless time of the present moment, we are actually separated by a number of time zones, are we not? I am currently on Eastern time. It's 8 a.m. in Toronto here, and you are where and when?
I am in Eastern India, in a rural area north of Calcutta.
And it's probably dusk there.
It is. It's already dark, yeah.
Dawn in Toronto, dusk in rural India. And for our listeners, whatever time they happen to be listening to this. So we're talking today about an interesting book called Cow Care in Hindu Animal Ethics. Before we talk about the actual book, I want to make note that the book is available to any of you listening immediately via open access. There is a link in the description of the podcast whereby you will be able to download the book. Do you want to say a little bit about open access and why you made that decision and what you think about that? That may be an interesting way to start.
Okay. When I saw this option offered by the publisher is Palgrave Macmillan, which is a subsidiary of Springer Nature, which is a very large international academic publisher. When I saw this option, at first I was a bit shocked by the price tag in order to get open access for a monograph. Palgrave charges $17,000, and I thought, okay, forget about that. But the more I thought about it, the more I had a desire that the book be available, that if I'm going to the trouble to research and write this book, I just want as many people as possible who would be interested to read it, to be able to read it. And that means people who may not be academics, as well as academics and so on. And of course, this sort of academic monograph at the regular hardbound price would be probably somewhere around $100, which makes it very restrictive. So talking with friends, talking with colleagues, the more I was encouraged that with some determined effort, I could do the fundraising. So I did basically a kind of crowdfunding, but it was quite targeted to people I know, and it became successful. The whole idea, of course, is open access is to make knowledge available to everyone without the restrictions that are there otherwise. And I'm just inspired to be part of that, to participate in that model of knowledge dissemination.
There's certainly a transformation afoot, a number of transformations, I think, not least of which, in my case, for the ways in which young scholars function as scholars, whether they're at institutions or not. But certainly there's a transformation afoot in terms of publishing. And initially, I think pejoratively, you know, the idea of open access, a colleague recommended it a couple of years ago, and I thought, let's not do that. And now the more I think about it, the more sure I am that this colleague and I will be putting together a collected volume that will be published open access. So for example, in my case, I have a book out and a forthcoming one, both with Routledge, excellent publishers. I had a fantastic experience, very pricey.
Yes.
And so certainly the university libraries will have no trouble procuring the book for research purposes, but certainly an interested student would not go and purchase it necessarily. And so there's much to be said about open access. And as far as I recall, this is the first open access book that I'm covering. So there you go. So enough about open
access. That's a distinction.
Another distinction, the first of 2020 officially. And so so here we are in a brave new world. Tell us about cow care and Hindu animal ethics. What is this book about?
Well, it's pretty much described in the title. The broad theme is animal ethics. Excuse me. And this is also the title of the book series in which this title is found. It's the Palgrave Macmillan Animal Ethics book series, which has at present 37 titles, including mine. And then the editor of this series, Andrew Lindsay, who I know personally, invited me to write a book on the subject of Hinduism and animal ethics. And he encouraged me very strongly. And the more I thought about it, I thought, okay, what will be particularly interesting from many perspectives will be the issue of cows. And what I'm calling cow care is, you could say, a translation of a somewhat traditional term, go-seva, as a Sanskrit term, where seva is sometimes translated as service, but it has more of a sense of attending and caring for, with here the implication being caring for them throughout their natural lives. And so I'm focusing on cows to open up the subject, the broader subject of animal ethics through the lens, you could say, of traditional Hindu thought. And what I mean by traditional is specifically the currents, what I call paradigms of Dharma, yoga, and bhakti. And what I'm trying to do is to bring these into conversation with contemporary animal ethics discourse, in particular animal rights, and then sort of on the side, the idea of animal welfare. And then more specifically, what has since recent times been called the ethics of care.
So what do you look at as evidence? What is your, you mentioned a Sanskrit term, and you do talk also about Sanskrit texts in the book, but tell us a little bit about your methods or your data, or what are you looking at for your book?
Yeah, I'm ranging rather widely. I'm starting in the first chapter with a kind of overview, a literary overview of texts, going back to the Rig Veda and then coming up through later texts, the Puranas, specifically the Bhagavata Purana, and into some pre-modern and modern Hindi texts. It's a kind of whirlwind tour in order to see what patterns are there in what I call the Hindu imaginaire of cows as somehow special animals. That's the first chapter. The second chapter is modern history, beginning with the late 19th century, looking very briefly at what comes to be called the cow protection movement, and then introducing important figures, starting with Dayanand Saraswati, then Mohandas Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, then as a kind of countervoice, B.R. Ambedkar, and then I end with A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who is the founder of what's popularly known as the Hare Krishna movement. Then that's one half of the second chapter. And then I go back into earlier texts to consider the modern controversy over to what extent, if at all, animal sacrifice has been performed according to earlier texts. So that controversy I deal with, especially looking at the Manusmriti. In the third chapter, I move into the present day situation in India. And for this, I did a bit of ethnography, despite my lack of training in ethnography. I traveled here in India, especially North India and Western India. And I visited cow sanctuaries or goshalas and interviewed people who are engaged in these practices of what I'm calling cow care. I then move into what I would say is the heart of my book, where I'm discussing ethics. And for that, again, I'm going back to older texts, but I'm also referring to contemporary Western discourse. So I'm especially discussing various writers, contemporary writers, including Sue Donaldson and Will Kimlicka in their book Zoopolis, and the work of, her name is slipping my mind now, Brinda Dalmia, who discusses about the ethics of care. So like that. And then with the next chapter, I am venturing into what I call the future of cow care. And for this, I'm looking specifically at two, what I call anticipatory communities. One of them is right here where I am presently, north of Calcutta, at the quite large community of ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, where they have a goshala of some 350 cows. And I also look at one community in Hungary, which is also of the same organization of ISKCON. So I'm giving a sketch of both of these. Again, I did some interviewing. Then I go into a different sort of a phase, but maybe we discuss that toward the end, because that's coming toward the end of the book.
So just to underscore for our listeners, there's a wide array of methods and data here where Kenneth is first looking at ancient classical Sanskritic texts to ascertain what he calls the Hindu imaginaire before moving on to doing the early history of modern Hinduism, essentially, looking at some key thinkers and their writings, and then venturing off into doing some ethnographic work with people who are alive in a body right now, related to modern movements on the globe, and what we may call modern Hinduism, or even new religious movements or social activism. So this is obviously a huge range. I highlight this not in any way to critique it, but to underscore the ambition of such a breadth of methods, which is fascinating. I often scratch my head as to why I didn't do ethnography myself. I love people, and they're my primary passion and livelihood these days. And then I read a passage in the Puranas or the Mahabharata. I'm like, oh, this is why. These tales are so gripping. Yeah. But I'll touch on the. Is this the first time you've included ethnographic work? Have you primarily been trained as a textualist?
I am primarily trained as a textualist, but for my doctoral research, which was on a quite different topic, I also did a bit of ethnography here in India. I was interviewing priests at one particular temple in Vrindavan. So I don't know if you can call that experience.
Let's take a look, maybe chronologically in the book, in terms of the Hindu imaginaire. Tell us a bit more about what that means to you as a concept. And also tell us what you conclude, what you find to be true of representations of cows in the Hindu imaginaire.
Yeah. This, what I'm calling imaginaire is, it's a term which probably traditionalist Hindus would not be very happy with, because the term suggests imagination of something which is perhaps non-existent. I don't really mean it in that way, but I do want to acknowledge that this is a textual survey, a literary survey. And the question that led my survey was, what sort of pattern or patterns are we going to find in this vast history that's going over basically a 3,000 year or more period? Is there going to be a consistent pattern or not? This is perhaps possibly because there are those who will say that this idea of cow protection, the cow protection movement, is a completely modern development. And yeah, something of my motivation is perhaps to question that. There does seem to be a long-term stream, and although it's certainly with various varied interpretation over time, I think it's there is also consistency. What I came to conclude was that there are two polarities, and one polarity is what I'm calling a value polarity between, on the one end, Dharma, and on the other end, Bhakti, where the Dharma concern is one of order, of responsiveness to a cosmic order, which is maintained in particular through the ritual processes, especially centered in yajna, in what we usually translate as sacrifice. And on the other end of that polarity is bhakti, which is, well, it's about emotion, but it's about emotion which is directed in a certain way, and which we could say is also about crossing over boundaries. And so what I'm suggesting is that cows end up somewhere in the middle of these boundaries, and at the same time, they become objects objects of wonder, going back to the Rig Veda, and they become, at the same time, there are hints of them becoming not objects so much as subjects. And I think this is where the bhakti value becomes prominent, associating cows in particular with the divinity Krishna, and then the entire theology that goes along with attention to Krishna and his worship. And then there's another polarity, and that is a polarity of meaning, where on the one side we have literal cows, one end of the polarity, and at the other end we have, we may say, figurative cows. And this polarity is very prominent as already in the Rig Veda, so that the Rig Veda is describing persons who are owners of cows and are happy to be the owners of cows, and who want that these cows are protected and are considered well situated because they have cows. And on the other extreme of the polarity, there are figurative cows. The rays of the dawn are cows. The flowing waters which are released by Indra from Vritra are cows. Speech is cow, and it goes on and on, and it extends to sort of confound any effort to simplify what is even meant by the word cow. So that was the initial idea.
If you could speculate, why would you conclude that the cow plays such a central role in Hindu culture?
Certainly there are practical reasons of utility, that cows were the source of wealth because, speaking of an agricultural or a pastoral society, the ownership of cows was bringing well-being, especially in the form, well, ritually with respect to milk, and for farming through the powers of the bull to plow and so on. That's, however, I would say that this is looking at the situation superficially. It's not really telling the deeper story, which is understood and which is indicated in this literature, that human well-being has to do very much with a relationship to nature, which in a sense is particularly mediated through cows. And we come back to the question, okay, but why cows and why not camels, or what, you know, we can sort of persist with that question. But the answer of Hindus would generally be something like, well, that's the way it is. This is the higher arrangement, the higher divine arrangement. Cows are what they are because of divine arrangement. They would also typically say that, speaking of divinity, that divinity is specifically present in cows in so many different forms, something which I discussed in the beginning of the second chapter.
So tell us what you found out or what you concluded about animal sacrifice.
Animal sacrifice was no doubt practiced. It has been practiced over the centuries, up to recent times. There are references to it in Jaipur area in the 18th century of the Common Era. And we hear reports of different kinds of sacrifice going on at the present time. This sort of grand rituals that were performed according to the texts in ancient times, I would say there's no reason to believe that they did not happen. How often they would have happened is certainly difficult to ascertain, but there's no reason to believe that they would not have happened. What we find in a somewhat later text, the Dharma Shastra, in particular Manusmriti, is an interesting mix of positions. First of all, it acknowledges very much that rituals of animal sacrifice are going on, and it's approving of such performances, rituals, in the sense that it's saying, if you want to be following Dharma with respect to the killing of animals, then you have no choice but to do so in the ritual context of the formal sacrifice. And if you do otherwise, you risk very serious karmic reactions, we may say. So certainly these activities were going on, and at the same time, there was an increased sense that this is somehow not ideal, perhaps that it is excessive, perhaps that it should be stopped altogether, but never is it said that the Vedic injunctions should be rejected. They may be substituted when injunction is there to sacrifice an animal. There may be substitution with non-animal substance, with ghee, with grain, and so on. But it's never, the Veda is always sacrosanct. It's always something which is somehow non-negotiable.
So in setting the stage, talking about cows in the Hindu imaginaire and certainly why they're significant for the culture and even in the context of religious sacrifice, tell us about these Hindu figures, these voices that you weave into your work, Gandhi's, Dayananda Saraswati, Ambedkar. What are they saying and why is it important for your work?
Yes. First, Dayananda Saraswati from the late 19th century. He is better known for his founding of the Arya Samaj. Wrote a 15-page tract on cow protection. And I'm introducing him because it seems that this tract was highly influential, going beyond the sphere of his own followers of the Arya Samaj. And it seems to have set in motion something of a chain reaction of organizations being established for cow protection. So he very much marks, in a way, the beginning of this modern movement that becomes the cow protection movement. Gandhi is interesting because, although he is especially celebrated and known for his emphasis on ahimsa, nonviolence with respect to political action and activism, in his writings, I would argue that he did not separate this from what he considered part of the same activity of nonviolence, which was to be nonviolent with respect to animals and in particular cows. Now, both Gandhi and Dayanand Sarasvati identified their concern for cows with Hinduism. Ambedkar brings in, as I said, a kind of counter voice because, as we well know, Ambedkar was quite at odds with Gandhi on particular issues, especially untouchability. And this is relevant for our discussion because Ambedkar wrote a whole book on the subject of untouchability and its origins. And in that, he discusses this matter of meat eating and how it is identified with the so-called outcasts or untouchables. And he speculates on how that came about. In such a way, through the development of Buddhism, in such a way that the Brahmins of the Hindu traditions, essentially wanted to be one better than the Buddhists by being more nonviolent than the Buddhists, with the side effect, if you like, that the lower castes, those who were depending, for example, on preparing hides from dead cows, became outcasts, became held in their positions of being untouchables, what we now call Dalits. The fourth person that I mentioned contrasts with all three of the first three, Bhaktivedanta Swami, because his concern is not with cows in relation to Hinduism, but rather his concern is with cows in relation to what he would identify as Sanatan Dharma, or with what he would call Vedic tradition, using that term in a broad sense, more specifically, he would identify with his own tradition, the Vaishnava tradition. In this context, Bhaktivedanta Swami in his missionary activity of bringing that tradition outside of India also encouraged his followers to establish farm communities in which cows would be kept, would be cared for life, and significantly would not be distinguished as so-called Deshi cows or indigenous cows of India, but rather any cows, bos taurus or bos indicus, was not the issue for him. So all of these together present a kind of overview and sketch of what is certainly a much more complex situation of modern history of cow protection. But my purpose is just to give somewhat impressionistic, but I think nonetheless helpful perspective on the modern situation.
So tell us about the modern situation. There's a number of
of points of entry. But I think it should be clear already from this discussion that that the notion of animal rights is particularly nuanced and perhaps even it's very different in this case. This isn't just a situation of the way in which we think of animal rights in the West. Would you agree with that?
Mm. Yes, animal rights has been promoted in the West based on ethical thinking that goes back to, you know, the Enlightenment, where the kind of reasoning that goes into the rights understanding, I would say, is very legalistic. It's a very legalistic approach, which, yeah, you can also trace back to ethics. Well, it's a response to Aristotle, ultimately, where Aristotle did not think that animals had any rights. The whole notion of rights you can trace to more recent times with the development of human rights in various spheres, to the point where we start to question, well, why only humans? Why not also animals? Since animals are sentient beings. The granting of moral status to animals is a key idea here. So I don't want to say that animal rights discourse in India is completely divorced from that. I don't think we can make a sharp separation because animal ethics discourse in India has been also very much influenced by Western thought because of India being part, because of India being very much involved with European discourse since the last 200 years.
So tell us about your the case studies. Tell us about the ethnographic work. What have you discovered?
I, as I said, I met with various people who are involved with, in particular, I visited people who are managers of what are called goshalas. Goshala means essentially a shelter or a sanctuary for cows. And the questions I had were, on the one side, practical questions, what's involved in the management, and in particular, what's involved in the economics of these institutions, how are they supported, and so on. And I wanted to get a sense of their mentality. What is motivating them to do what they're doing? I met people who have very small number of cows. I met one lady from Germany who is right here where I am now in Mayapur, who has been keeping around 10 cows by herself over many years. I also met with the leader on the other extreme in southwest Rajasthan. I met a person who is the inspiration for, he doesn't manage himself, but he's the inspiration for an organization, Patmeda, which has some 45,000 cows. And then I met also near Delhi, one manager who is a retired brigadier general, a manager of NGO combination with, it's called a PPP, public-private, I forget, institution, which has some 3,000 cows. So a wide range of numbers of cows. Many of these places are rescue operations. And this is interesting because it shows the disconnect that's happening very much in India as a result of its very fast modernization, industrialization, and so on, that we see so many cows wandering the streets. And because now there's a rapid increase in the number of cars, the amount of traffic on the roads, more and more of these cows get injured. Although there is a tradition in India of respecting cows and being careful not to harm them, it seems that people are becoming more and more careless. And so these cows are, typically they will be rescued and they'll be brought into one of these shelters where they will receive some treatment and where they may then remain for the rest of their lives. Also, a related phenomenon with cows wandering the streets is that because they have nothing for their nourishment, then the garbage in various garbage collection points, and because that garbage is typically having food which is within plastic bags, we find that cows are eating not only the food but also the plastic bags. And what is that doing? It's going into their stomach, their stomachs, and eventually it's killing them. So we have this rather odd situation in India of, on the one side, people will readily say that cows are in some way special. Perhaps they're even to be revered, perhaps even worshipable. And on the other side, we see so many cows are neglected. They don't seem to be prized at all, but quite the opposite. The Goshalas are an attempt to respond to that. And I have to say, this is a as I see it, a stopgap effort. It's not really addressing the bigger issue. In the early 1970s, there was a major push in India by the central government to develop the dairy industry. And this effort was extremely successful. By the 1990s, India was measured as having the largest dairy industry in the world. Now, this was, of course, very good for the dairy industry and for the owners of the cows giving the milk. But if we then ask, so what happens to those cows when they are giving less milk and then giving no milk? And of course, the answer is they will be sold for slaughter. And so what I suggest in this book is that we have to see the dairy industry as an extension of the meat and leather industry. And as it turns out, the meat and leather industry are substantial industries in India. This is, again, somewhat, I would say, an anomaly for India. Speaking with these people, I was very much struck by their their dedication, their conviction that cows are, that to care for cows is a special kind of responsibility, a duty of human beings. Some of them at times would wax poetic and very devotional about the need for dedication for their care. And also, I found it interesting the sorts of benefits that they would speak of having cares beyond the more physical benefits that are usually referred to, having the milk, and also much is spoken of the cow dung as being particularly valuable for regenerating soil. Beyond these values, they spoke of what I call intangible values or intangible benefits. Simply having cows is bringing human well-being. It's bringing peacefulness. It's bringing balanced life. It's bringing economic balance as a kind of side effect. So these sorts of ideas were very much expressed.
So in terms of these officials and these cow care projects, would you say that they were motivated by what you would call Hindu piety? To what extent would you say that's the case? That's the, that their prime motivation is inextricable from their conception of being a Hindu, or even latching on to what you mentioned as resonating with the Hindu imaginaire?
Yes, there's certainly a lot of identification with being Hindu. And this is something that I am concerned about in the book, is what is their understanding of being Hindu? I would say to a large extent, this becomes unfortunately very much tied in with Hindutva, with this sort of politicized notions of Hindu tradition or Hinduism. Which turns into, of course, the very dark side of communalism. Indeed, they would often say that when we speak of cows, we mean Desi cows, we mean Indian cows. I came across a video of a speech of one very senior government official pronouncing this publicly, almost exactly in these words: when we mean cows, we mean Desi cows, and we don't care what happens to your Western so-called cows. This, I think, is a misunderstanding. Who am I to say as an outsider, but I will say anyway that I find this a misunderstanding of the tradition itself. If we go back to the Bhagavad Gita, which Hindus will certainly identify with, which of course never uses the word Hindu, what we find is what's being celebrated is a vision of equality in which all beings, whether cow or elephant or dog or so-called dog eater or Brahmin, all are seen by the Samadarshan, by the person who sees equally. So, yes, they do identify very much with being Hindu. To a large extent, there are exceptions, there is that tendency today in India to make that identification. Hindu, someone who cares for cows is a Hindu. Someone who is Hindu cares for cows, something like that.
So if we can bracket off for a moment, perhaps some of the more extreme tendencies of, you know, only they shoot cows are of value. Would you say then, how do I phrase the question? So it really is only the cow among all creatures in India that could elicit this sort of care, veneration even. Would you say that is the case?
Well, I don't think we can make absolutes like that. We have people who are extremely concerned about other animals. Elephants, for example, there are people who are very, very much concerned about elephants being endangered and being mistreated. I don't know. There are certainly other animals. A contrast might be made. In India, of course, you'll see dogs everywhere being very much sort of neglected, and they're just street dogs and so on. But then just a few days ago, I was in Ahmedabad, and we visited one Jain animal hospital where they were treating dogs, you know, with the greatest of devotion, one could say, and where they were lining up they were preparing for a sudden influx of birds, because I don't know if this is all over India, but around this time there is this kite flying festival, and they fly kites using string which has glass powder. And this glass powder, why they do this is they're competing. They're trying to cut the string of another kite. But as a result, they're cutting also the wings of birds. And so this particular shelter or animal hospital I visited said they expect some 2,000 birds to be brought in the course of a few days.
That's incredible. What would you hope, what do you intend is the main takeaway or the main takeaways of this fascinating book?
The main takeaway I would say is, can we kind of step back from the animal ethics discourse as it's been articulated in the West, to bring in other voices, in this case, from the, I use this word Hindu guardedly because it is problematic in so many ways, but from the Hindu tradition, out of convenience using that term, can we benefit from some sources or resources of that tradition? And I'm again calling attention to the Dharma, Yoga, and Bhakti traditions. And specifically what I want to suggest the contribution of these might be is a metaphysics to undergird or to serve in some sort of foundational way to our concern that animals' sentience is being ignored, or is that animals are suffering at the hands of human beings in such vast numbers. Just cows, cows alone, the number is some 300 million being slaughtered per year. That's not to speak of all the other types of animals. But I want to suggest that there's a certain vision here that if we can sort of brush aside the superficialities, the misunderstandings of some elements of modern Hinduism, that could actually help us to think more deeply and more effectively to address a problem which is not just about feeling good in our ethics, but which is about getting our planet back into some semblance of natural balance. And the fact that human beings on this planet have made it a commonhood that we eat meat as much as we like, and in particular of cows. In this situation, it's becoming more and more clear that this has to change, but we need some sort of philosophical, theological backing, I would say, to bring us forward. And I'm just hoping this book will contribute something to that. A lot more needs to be said than I've said in this book. This is by no means the last word. A lot needs to be said about the economics of cow care than I was able to manage with this book. Maybe that's going to be a second book. I don't know.
And perhaps when it's out, we'll be speaking about it on this podcast.
Yes.
So thank you very much. We've been speaking today with Kenneth Valpe, who is a research fellow at the Oxford Center for Hinduism.
Yeah. The Oxford Center for Hindu Studies.
For Hindu Studies, that's right. We've been speaking about, of course, his fascinating new book, Cow Care in Hindu Animal Ethics, which is available open access via the link in the description of this podcast. Thank you very much for your time today.
Can I add one more little request to the audience?
Of course.
If anyone would be interested in reviewing the book for a journal, that would be much appreciated.
Okay, then. How shall they contact you, or what is your request?
I would suggest they download the book, and if they can do a review based on the electronic version of the book, that makes it that would be the easiest. And otherwise, yes, they could contact me.
Okay, once again, we're speaking with Kenneth Valpe on his new book, Cow Care in Hindu Animal Ethics. Thank you very much, and until next time, keep reading.